Hi, everybody, and welcome to The Stone Chapel, a podcast of the staff and friends of the Lanier Theological Library in Houston, Texas. My name is David Capes. I'm the Senior Research Fellow at the Library and your host for this series of podcasts. Our purpose is fairly simple. We want to bring to you great conversations with leading experts from around the world on biblical, theological, historical, and archaeological themes. Well, the list goes on. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. This is part two of my conversation with Dr. Bruce Chilton. If you haven't heard part one, please go back and do that. On this podcast, we talk about the phenomena of the dying and rising gods or demigods in the ancient world and what that may or may not have to do with the resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth. One of the objections I've heard through the years is to the Christian faith is that the world at the time of Jesus was filled with dying and rising gods, and Jesus is just one of those. But and you do deal with that early in the book, as I recall, with other dying and rising gods, little g, I'll put it that way. So how is that criticism valid, or is there something unique in the
I think that the criticism is misstated for several reasons. One is that the idea of the possibility of being raised from the dead does appear in ancient literature. In the case of figures such as Utnapishtim in the Epic of Gilgamesh, in the Osiris cycle from Egypt, in the case of Dionysos of Greece and Tammuz in Syria. And these are brilliant stories, and that is the reason that I took some time in the first part of the book simply putting those together. Because one of the elements in them, which is quite striking, is that these are all dealt with as being extremely rare and exceptional events. And they are unlike the teaching of Jesus' resurrection for a pivotal reason, and that is Jesus' resurrection is portrayed throughout the New Testament as being the moment of transformation for humanity as a whole. That is, this is the indication that he is what Paul calls the primal offering, the offering in the springtime. Traditionally rendered first fruits.
But I
don't use the language of first fruits because it always puzzles people when I say it. That means primal offering. That is the offering in the spring. Jesus is portrayed as the springtime resurrection for humanity.
New creation language.
It is a new creation. That's right. Which is why Paul goes on to use that language so signally. And of course, these dying and rising gods, as they are called that for a good reason, and that is that they are either wholly divine or semi-divine for the most part. There's an element of divinity within them. The exception to this is Utnapishtim in the Epic of Gilgamesh, but even so, the only reason that he is immortal is that he is given a special visitation of the gods early on. That's not the portrayal in the New Testament of Jesus' resurrection, because as you can see from this same passage in 1 Corinthians 15 you pointed us to, the mortality of Jesus is emphasized, that he died, according to the scriptures, as well as being raised according to the scriptures. And this comes from what is the earliest text concerning his resurrection that there is. One of my purposes in the book is to give 1 Corinthians 15 pride of place, because I think there's been a tendency to try to fit this text into the notion that somehow the story of the so-called empty tomb were primal. Whereas, in fact, Paul is writing this first, around the year 56. The only person to have been involved in the disclosure of Jesus' presence, who wrote down what happened, the only person, and who does so at a period very close in time to the disclosure he's referring to. Mm-hmm. And he also talks about the others. Mm. So that one of my methods within this study is to relate the various stories of the resurrection that we have in the Gospels to the people that Paul here enumerates. Mm. So we can look for stories that concern Peter or Kepha, mm-hmm. Stories that concern the 12, mm-hmm. that concern a large number of people, more than 500. I relate that to Pentecost, as has been suggested before. Mm-hmm. I factor
most of whom are still alive. He says
he's
at that point.
Exactly right. That's right.
So at 56 A.D. or C.E. right, they're still living. At
they're
that
still
point.
Alive.
Right.
Yeah.
So
some 20 years later.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Why not?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I give James his due, and the brother of Jesus, and point out that although it is often said that Paul excludes Mary Magdalene from this list, in fact, he does refer to all the apostles. Mm. Mm. And so other figures who are tradents of this material regarding the resurrection, Mary Magdalene, Silas, Barnabas, are, I think, included
contained.
Within this list.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Now, some of them we can't trace further. I mean, wouldn't it be interesting sometime
if we could.
To know what Apollos thought about the resurrection, how he taught that, or those called apostles by Paul elsewhere in Romans, mm-hmm. what would they have taught?
What would they have said about it?
That would be interesting to know.
Yeah.
But I think the least we can do is do them justice when they are named by Paul by linking their identities with the particular stories that we have in the New Testament. And each of them develops the understanding of how Jesus is raised mm-hmm. with an understanding of how Jesus commands them forward. So it is forgiveness in the case of Peter. In the case of the 12, it is making disciples.
Mm. Go it make disciples of the nations.
Exactly.
Right.
In the case of the more than 500, it's really going out to those nations aggressively. Mm. In the case of James, the brother of Jesus, this was the beginning of his constant presence in the temple in Jerusalem, where he became known for his persistent loyalty to the Nazarite vow, not only to the followers of Jesus, but to the population of Jerusalem. He became venerated as someone who understood how purity within the temple could be achieved, and he did this by his dedication to his understanding of the risen presence of Jesus. Mm. Silas becomes someone of extreme importance within the development of the apocalyptic tradition. It's very interesting that his name shows up either in its Greek form, Silas, or its Latin form, Silvanus, wherever there is an apocalyptic interest in the New Testament.
Mm. I don't think I had noticed that.
Yeah, if you just follow his name through.
Yeah, follow that name.
When he's around with Paul or where he's named in the first letter of Peter, one can see an increased apocalyptic interest. And his activity, when he is sent out from Jerusalem by James to deliver the apostolic decree in Acts chapter 15, when he goes to Antioch, he's described as prophesying, which is exactly the term that's used in terms of an apocalyptic teacher.
Preacher and teacher.
That's right. So the resurrection is a ethically transformative experience.
He didn't mention Paul. I'm curious what you would say about Paul, because there's been a debate going on. Was he converted or was he called?
I think in Paul's case, he lies very close to the commission of those more than 500 brothers. And in fact, this may be why he refers to their still being alive, most of them, because I think he classes himself in that group.
Not in the 12, not up there with Peter in a way.
Exactly.
And, or the brother of Jesus.
Or the brother of Jesus.
Right.
And it's interesting, of course, he winds up in dispute with James over the issue of food sacrificed to idols. He winds up accusing Peter of hypocrisy.
In the book of Galatians.
And he...
So all wasn't goodness and light in the early church.
It was not. That's right. Yeah. He sees himself more accommodated to the view of the more than 500 in understanding that because the Jesus who was raised is raised a human being and encountered that way. Mm. This revelation is for humanity as a whole.
For the nations.
For the nations.
Yeah.
And therefore, you have to cross the line between Israel and the nations, unnatural though that was for Paul at the time. And he makes that as his own commission, which is why he says, again, in Galatians, when the one who called me from my mother's womb was pleased to disclose himself to me, to announce his name to the nations. His very apostolic purpose, as Paul understands it, is aligned with the function of the more than 500.
The apostle to the Gentiles.
And that's why he is the apostle to the Gentiles.
Yeah.
Exactly. And why in this chapter of 1 Corinthians, which in my opinion is the best written chapter in all of Pauline literature. It is simply exquisitely structured. It's carefully presented. The argument, in my opinion, is pristine and really quite delicate. Why this is as close as we ever get to a description of the resurrection as what I describe as an anthropology. You know, how is it that people, as well as Jesus, can be understood as arising from the dead? Paul here gives you an actual science of how that occurs.
Which is interesting because you use that word science in a variety of ways in your book. And that phrase, the science of the resurrection, stuck out for me.
I'm glad it did. It was a working title of the book at one stage.
Oh, the science of resurrection.
Exactly. And then the publisher, I think, wisely suggested to me that because I also dealt with other issues, we should go with the more inclusive resurrection logic. So
yeah,
I was
great
happy,
title. Yeah.
Happy to agree with that.
Yeah.
But the reason I refer to science of resurrection is that, take the example of Paul here. He has to face the question, how can resurrection be something that occurs for people as a whole? What is it about humanity that makes it even possibly resurrected? We are not simply immortal at birth. What brings about this transformation?
So this immortality of the soul is distinct from this notion of resurrection.
It certainly is.
And it's part of what is a human being.
Right? That's right.
What is a human being?
How is a human being made?
Right.
And in fact, Paul goes out of his way, and this is, I think, one of the difficulties of understanding Paul. He goes out of his way to refute the idea that we are physical on the one hand, and then that we have immortal souls. That is not the way he views humanity. Instead, when Paul conceives of a human being, he believes that a human being is always a body. But he doesn't use the word body in the way that we do. He doesn't think that one's body is the same thing as one's flesh. There's such a thing as a physical body. We all know that we have a physical body because we can see them around us.
Right.
But he also holds that we also have a body that he calls a somasukikon, a, we would say, translating literally, a psychic body. that is a body of soul. That is, human beings are not simply flesh, they're also self-aware. But in Paul, that soul dies too. When you die, the soul goes. That's part of our mortality. That's not the end, because there's also such a thing, in his view, as spiritual body. And because God also is spirit, when one is spiritual body, one makes this transformation.
Yes.
And for Paul, it is Jesus who discloses that and makes it possible for a new humanity to arise. So he makes the classic analysis. We have all borne the image of Adam, the first man.
Man of dust.
The man of dust. Yes. That's why we're in the shape we're in.
That's right.
But we also can bear the image of the man of heaven. And so the story of the resurrection is not for Jesus alone. It is for humanity at large. And this, I think, quite exact science that Paul develops has, I think, tragically been ignored. There was a tendency during the Middle Ages, especially, not to make the distinction between physical body, soul's body, and spiritual body, but just to speak about body as if it were physical and soul as if it were immortal. This is more the influence of Stoic philosophy than it is the influence of Paul. And it might be a good understanding to grow out of and to see the way in which Paul approaches this whole question.
Well, I could see sort of a theological anthropology coming out of this, you know, and really delving deeply into how Paul thinks about what a human being really is.
What a really truly is involved. And that's why there's also a strong link between what he says here in chapter 15 and earlier in chapter 2, when he's dealing with the question of how it's even possible for human beings to know about God. And Paul argues it's because of our capacity to deal with the spiritual things of God. There's something about our humanity that has a resonance with that aspect of God. And that's what makes him as confident as he is about breaching the line between Israel and the nations, which earlier he would never have done. So think, here's another example of the way in which the resurrection is not only a teaching about transformation, it actually transforms. I mean, Paul is not the same.
Not just a doctrine to be learned and think about.
It really is not. It really, and he, there, Peter is not Peter until then.
He's Simon before then, right?
Really?
Simon before then. We've been talking to Dr. Bruce Chilton about his book, Resurrection Logic, How Jesus' First Followers Believed God Raised Him from the Dead, by Baylor University Press. Dr. Chilton, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Thanks to Brent Johnson and Janet Seifert for editing these podcasts. Thanks as well to Phil Keggy for our music. These podcasts are made possible by the generosity of Mark and Becky Lanier and the Lanier Theological Library Foundation. If you have questions, comments, or would just like to be in touch, please email us at podcast@lanierlibrary.org. Lanier is L-A-N-I-E-R. Thanks for listening.